April 6th. The decision was between Zambrano and right-hander Ryan Dempster, and Pinella says he chose Zambrano after talking it over with pitching coach Larry Rothschild. Minnesota defeated Northwestern 66-53 in the first round of the Big Ten tournament this afternoon. Minnesota now advances to play top-seeded Michigan State in the quarterfinals tomorrow. In Big 12 tourney play, number 22 Kansas State defeated Colorado 68-51. Kansas State faces number 10 Texas A&M tomorrow in the Big 12 quarterfinals. The San Jose Sharks look to regain sole possession of the league lead tonight when they visit the St. Louis Blues. The Sharks are tied with Detroit at 96 points, one ahead of East-leading Boston. The Blues, meanwhile, are in 11th place in the West, 3 points behind Nashville for the final postseason berth. And Illinois Governor Pat Quinn says he has agreed to raise Illinois' financial guarantee from $150 million to $250 million for Chicago's bid for the 2016 Olympic Games. The request comes amid concerns that Chicago's bid is at a competitive disadvantage because it doesn't include the full government guarantees offered by rival finalists Tokyo, Madrid, and Rio de Janeiro. The governor says every Olympic game held in the United States has made a lot of money, so he sees the guarantee as an insurance policy, and he doesn't think it will be necessary to use the money. That's sports.
Carpet Weavers on Market View Drive in Champaign supports programs on WILL. For 20 years, Carpet Weavers has been serving Central Illinois' floor covering and interior needs with nationally recognized brands like Armstrong, Mannington, Mohawk, Shaw, Flex Steel Furniture, and Hunter Douglas Window Treatments. More information is at carpetweavers.info.
Ford has released the details of its cost-cutting agreement with United Auto Workers. General Motors and Chrysler are expected to make their own deals before the end of the month. Michigan Radio's Tracy Samilton reports.
Gone forever is Ford's jobs bank that paid laid-off workers while they waited for a new job to open up at the company. Gone, too, is a chunk of daily break time, Easter Monday holiday, cost of living increases, and bonuses. Ford will also pay half of what it owes the UAW for retiree health care in stock instead of cash. Joe Hendricks is vice president of North American manufacturing for Ford. He says the changes save Ford $500 million a year and bring labor costs close to those at competitors like Toyota.
We feel very, very good about the agreement that we reached, but also recognize that it's fair and reasonable to our employees given the excess that we have and given the economy that we're in.
Ford workers may have felt they had no choice. Union leaders told the rank and file that rejecting the concessions would eventually doom Ford. Harley Shaken studies labor issues at UC Berkeley. He says the high percentage of yes votes was not a surprise.
No one feels this recession harder than auto workers in Detroit.
Shaken says Ford gained an advantage by going first with the UAW. Now the union will try to use the deal to limit concessions at Chrysler and General Motors, two companies worse off than Ford. Both must cut a deal with the union by March 31st, or the federal government could demand the return of its loans, triggering bankruptcy. For NPR News, I'm Tracy Samilton in Ann Arbor.
Central Americans coming to the United States often take a perilous 1,000-mile journey across Mexico. Thousands take that trip riding a freight train so dangerous they call it the train of death. Most Americans know nothing about these travels, but that may change with the release this month of the film Sin Nombre, which won top awards at the Sundance Film Festival. It's writer-director Cary Fukunaga's thrilling fictional account of Hondurans riding the train and clashing with a violent gang called MS-13. Murray Carpenter reports.
There are three border rivers to cross in the 1,000-mile journey from Honduras to the U.S. Veterans of the trip say they're tres veces mojado, or three times wet. That's also the title of a popular Mexican song.
Por eso dicen que soy tres veces mojado.
Ana Rosales, a 23-year-old undocumented immigrant from Honduras, lives in New York. She knows all about these rivers and the land between. Last winter, she traveled for 6 weeks by bus, boat, boot, and freight train from Tegucigalpa to San Antonio. And she says riding the train was rough.
We were on the train for 5 days, again, without food and water.
Rosales has much in common with Syra, the protagonist of Sin Nombre. Syra is a Honduran teen traveling with her father and uncle across Guatemala and Mexico. Along the way, they meet Good Samaritans offering food and water, and vicious gang members with tattooed faces, wielding machetes and homemade shotguns. Riding the train, Syra connects with Casper, a Mexican teenager fleeing his turbulent past.
¿Y qué quieres?
Voy con vos.
What do you want? Casper asks Syra in this scene. I'm going with you, she says. Researching the film, Cary Fukunaga rode the rails himself for days at a time. Along the way, he says he met migrants who suggested titles.
One was like, yeah, you should call the film like El Tren de la Muerte. And I was just like, man, that sounds like a horror film. I'm not going to call it The Train of Death. And I heard other people call it La Bestia, you know, like La Bestia would be like another word for the devil, you know. Those are all strong words for the train. And it is, literally can be a train of death.
The train earned its reputation from the risks of leaping onto rolling cars. And there are other hazards. One night, while Fukunaga was among hundreds of migrants riding through Chiapas, the train stopped in the middle of nowhere. Soon, there was a scuffle.
Three gunshots rang out, and then all hell broke loose. Everyone started screaming. People were running. They're yelling, pandilla, pandilla, which means gangster.
Fukunaga stayed put in the darkness, not wanting to lose a good spot on the crowded train. He says it wasn't until late the next day that he heard what had happened.
A young Guatemalan kid had some money, and he didn't want to give it up to the bandits, and so they shot him and threw him off the train.
As the train rolled into the next night, nobody knew if the bandits were still aboard. It's this sort of tension that Fukunaga wrote into the script. And even though it's not a documentary, he says he was determined to pin down the details, right down to the rattling, clanking rumble of the railroad.
When it speeds up or slows down, if you're on it, it's like an earthquake, because it yanks, and then it yanks each car, each preceding car, each following car yanks, either stopping or speeding up, and it will just knock you right off your feet. And that's actually how people fall off the train.
Fukunaga says in order to get things right, he filmed in Mexico and gave the leading male role to a Honduran with almost no acting experience.
I think the idea of authenticity kind of covers all of that. It covers the idea of why make the film in Spanish, why cast out of Central America, why do the journey, why do all that research.
When he talked to migrants, Fukunaga says he kept asking them why they would risk so much to take the journey. And they told him poverty is the primary motivation. Ana Rosales says it's something most Americans just don't get.
They don't understand why we come to this country, to improve our economic situation. Because in our country, life is not easy. This is why we make the sacrifices to go to another country. Many people die on the journey.
In addition to the train footage, Fukunaga's film includes scenes shot at two river crossings. He says he hopes Sin Nombre will allow moviegoers to catch a glimpse of the struggles many Central Americans face to come to this country, even if it's only fleeting. For NPR News, I'm Murray Carpenter.
A lot of soldiers say war is hell, and then they won't say anything else. That wasn't good enough for one Chicago-area playwright. She's created a new collaboration called the Vet Art Project. It brings veterans and artists together to make art out of war. The group's vision is a big one. It aims to be a national model for how veterans can tell their stories and get the public to listen. Lynette Kalsness has the story.
I am Lisa, and this is the Vet Art Project, and welcome.
About a dozen people sit in a circle at the Chicago Cultural Center. Several are local playwrights, poets, and painters. The rest are men who have been to war. In the middle, there's a box of Kleenex, some cough drops, and M&Ms. It can hurt to turn war stories into art.
So we went out on our first mission.
Vietnam vet Bill Christ starts out.
That's when my first buddy got killed in an ambush. I was a pacifist myself. I was praying I never had to pull the trigger. But after that happened, I did a 180. I volunteered for every patrol I could go on.
Christ was hit by shrapnel from two grenades, but he made it home, and he thought he could fit right in.
And that wasn't the case. I felt distant, pure lack of trust. I went over to my one buddy's house. He had a little welcome home party after my parents. And without even thinking, I said, hey, you guys get a lot of racket or mortar attacks around here?
Coming back is one of the strangest things I'll ever go through in my life, I'm sure.
Matt Ping sits across the circle from Christ. He's a young vet who served in Afghanistan.
That transition from 16 months of isolation on the side of a mountain and being secluded from American society and American people, and then coming back and trying to be the same person you were before, it's really I don't know if it's even possible.
A recent study by the RAND Corporation found that nearly 20% of soldiers who served in Iraq and Afghanistan have post-traumatic stress disorder or depression. Only half seek treatment. Pink says part of the problem is Americans don't seem to know or care about the war or its soldiers. He recalls being in Afghanistan in the thick of it and soldiers not being able to reach anxious family members.
And that's probably why the suicide rates are so high, because that's the easiest out. I mean, I'm not going to lie, I sat there with a barrel of a gun in my mouth thinking about pulling the trigger more than once. And, you know, I'm glad I didn't, because I was just in an altered state at the time.
Do you guys have anyone you can talk to?
The curly-haired woman really leading the group nods in sympathy. There are a few teary eyes. The stories of war eventually wind down.
Why don't we move to the other side of the room?
The group moves over to a table covered with paper and glue to make collages that reflect the stories they just heard. The inaugural month of the Vet Art Project included art activities and talks like this. It drew roughly 25 vets and 50 artists, and the number keeps growing. Lisa Rosenthal is the playwright behind it all. She says she got the idea after hearing an interview about the healing process for vets.
In order to heal, veterans need to talk. They need to talk to a therapist. They need to talk to a peer group in a peer group setting. But they also need to share their stories with the community. And I thought artists can build that bridge between the veterans and the community.
It's a bridge constructed of images and words drawn from sometimes reluctant war veterans, says art therapist Sue Ellen Semikoski.
They don't want to cause any more suffering. They don't want to contaminate the people they love with their stories of horror and suffering. You know, they want the sufferings to stop. And they hold it all themselves.
Semikoski, who teaches art therapy at the School of the Art Institute, says art can help calm vets and offer an indirect and safe way to share painful memories. Some of the veterans in the project, like Matt Ping, wrote their own songs and poems. Others, like Bill Crest, told their stories and collaborated with writers who created plays.
In Darkness, Cliff Fall center stage.
It's the first read-through with the actors and Chris play. Director Lila Stromer asks him to tell about the day that his buddy Cliff stepped on a landmine.
So I was going to grab him and pull him back in the grass until I looked down. He was so full of holes and blood that I honestly thought that he was going to pull in half if I tried to drag him. So instead, I stayed out there with him. And as I washed the blood off his face, I saw his eye hanging out of the socket. And I just happened to have that medical pack on me, so I took it, and I just remember putting his eye back in the socket.
Actors Ray Reddy and Joe Lehman turned back to the script.
My face is on fire.
Okay, Cliff, it's me, Bill. I'm here. You're not alone.
Vets like Chris, who take part in this project, are watching and hearing their worst memories being replayed.
If I start talking about some things, it's like I just see through a wall. I see it actually happening again, right on the spot. Not a flashback, but a flash movie.
He says he's going through this because he wants people to know how war affects the mind and that it happens to real people. But he's surprised to find the telling and retelling has helped him, too.
They make things a lot more livable for me. I've noticed that things have loosened up a little bit for me, coming here and talking to them.
And it's not just people who have been to war who need a creative outlet. Nancy Ronquillo is the mother and wife of soldiers. Her son Matt was on the invasion force in Iraq. Ronquillo says he came home depressed and broken. 4 months later, he died in a car crash with his military buddy. She thinks the soldiers were used to Iraq, where they had to speed to avoid rockets.
My son's name won't be on a granite wall or the driver of the car because he didn't die in the battlefield, but I'm sure he died of battle wounds. They were invisible. They were psychic injuries, but I know why he couldn't face life any longer.
Ronquillo says she survived by telling Matt's story in essays. Her words inspired artists here to create modern dance and a painting.
When I struggle with the fact that Matt's not alive, what I want is Matt's spirit in the world. And if Matt's spirit can be here healing, then I'm really happy about that. So
Ronquillo gets her first glimpse of the painting at the Vet Project's final show. The words of her essay are the background for portraits of grieving women from around the world. She hugs the artist.
It is so beautiful.
Oh, good.
Did you recognize it?
I was like, totally, totally blown away. You have done an incredible job.
The Vet Art Project's Lisa Rosenthal wants moments like this to happen across the country. She's writing a guide so other cities can replicate the experience. It's far from over in Chicago. More vets are calling, wanting to tell their stories, and a few VA centers have requested workshops. Some collaborations continue, like that of Matt Ping and his fellow musicians. They performed his songs about war at the final show and want to keep playing together.
Watch the pain drive men insane. I want to go back home again so I can rest my mind.
Ping is so excited after the show, he's almost giddy. He says he still feels isolated at times, but creating art gives him a break. It lets him forget everything for a while. I'm Lynette Kalsness.
Hear the sound and watch the sky. I pray to God that I don't die so I can be with you. Pardon me, oh, what can I say? Pardon me, oh, what can I say? A part of me will never be the same. Pardon me, oh.
Earth and sky.
Magma abounds inside the earth in many places, but we have never, ever encountered one. We talk about it, we try to find it, but no one's ever found one like this. And it's only the beginning.
You're listening to Earth scientist Bruce Marsh of Johns Hopkins University. He's excited about the first ever discovery of magma, molten material inside Earth. The dynamic movement of magma has helped shape the world on which we stand, but it took an accidental discovery by a drilling crew in Hawaii to find the first actual molten magma still inside Earth.
They were drilling down in a basically routine kind of drilling operation, and they started seeing some unusual looking materials coming up in the cuttings. They could tell that this material was actually coming right up the drill hole and then corking itself off through cooling from the drilling fluids.
Before this, scientists wondered whether they'd ever be able to study live magma near Earth's surface.
For me and for people who study magma, this is Jurassic Park for magmas. In other words, people who want to find would be just thrilled to find a dinosaur in its natural habitat. For us, this is magma in its natural habitat. This is first contact with inner Earth.
Today, we're celebrating the International Year of Planet Earth, thanks to the National Science Foundation and the U.S. Geological Survey. More at yearofplanetearth.org. We're Earth and Sky, a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
WILL programming is made possible by Strawberry Fields Natural Food Store, featuring locally grown and organic produce, freshly baked breads, a coffee bar, and bulk foods department. Strawberry Fields also offers natural vitamins, health and beauty products, household cleaning products, pet foods, and an in-store nutritionist to answer questions about healthy eating.
Coming up at 3 o'clock, The World from PRI. On the program today, malaria kills more than 1 million people each year.